honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, wrapping things up now with 93-year-old Dick Grantham of Arroyo Grande, California. We've heard quite a bit of his life story, but there are a few twists and turns still to come. When we hit the break, he had just learned that World War II was over. His ship would not need to participate in the planned invasion of Japan because Japan had surrendered. So how do you think that news was celebrated aboard ship?
So the skipper gave us all a little free cup of ice cream for celebrating the war was over. And so I'm eating a little cup of ice cream. And later on in years, after I got out of the Navy and all, they first came out with television, then it came out with television. This is some time I'd been working for the phone company for a while, and they were showing VJ Day on television. And this VJ Day was Hollywood. And Sunset Boulevard, it was wall-to-wall people in this movie that we was watching. And in this wall-to-wall people, then they showed this lady dancing with this sailor there on Sunset Boulevard, you know. And I saw that, and I thought, my God, I said, Betty, get in here quick. She was in the kitchen at the time. She said, get in here quick. And it was Betty dancing with this sailor. So I looked back, and at the end of the war, I had my little free cup of ice cream, and my wife's dancing with this sailor. What a revolting development.
Well, and your wife, who you hadn't really gotten to know yet, even though you'd grown up around each other, you didn't get to know her till after you got home from World War II. But that was the simultaneous situation. You're eating ice cream in the Pacific, she's dancing on Sunset Boulevard, and you don't realize that till how many years later?
Oh, that's quite a few, but what I think, the twin-engine bomber that crashed on our ship was nicknamed Betty. And yeah. And so I married a Betty.
A Betty almost killed you, and then you married a Betty.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Anyway, so now my dear wife has passed away, and I'm alone. But I do remember one thing. It wasn't over with for me, because I took our ship, the Elmo, and we sailed down through the Panama Canal in, I think, Atlanta, Georgia, somewhere there, to put a ship in mothballs. We did that, and I was put on leave, and they come back to California, and I was traveling to California, and I stopped in Texas. And in Texas, I went to the Air Force Base and hitchhiked a ride, because I was in the Navy, and I could do that, on a B-25 bomber. So these two pilots were taking some mail to California, and they said they'd take me. And so what I did is, I, no seat belt or anything, I sat on top of this pile of mail going to California. And these two cowboys, they were piloting their plane. They were really cowboys. And I remember my ears were ringing 2 weeks after I went back there. And then I was assigned to another ship, Kenneth Whiting. And they were testing an atomic bomb in Bikini Atoll. So in this test at Bikini Atoll, our ship was a seaplane tender at this time. And we had Dr. Sawyer, who was head of, he was the scientist ahead of the whole bomb thing, and he was on our ship. But anyway, in this test, we had two tests. One was an aerial bomb, atom bomb, and the other was an underwater blast. And the aerial blast was 2,000 feet in the air, they dropped this atomic bomb. And you could really... we were quite a distance from it, but we could sure feel the shock wave, tremendous. And then on the next one, we tested a month later, I guess, or so. There was an underwater blast. And the underwater blast, we were 8 miles from it, and we could see the whole thing and watch the whole thing go off. And I remember us sailors were looking at it, and this column of water went up in the air and mushroomed out. But in this column of water that was up, we noticed a cigar-shaped object in this column of water that went up. And we wondered, what's that cigar-shaped object in that column of water? Well, I found out later on that cigar-shaped object was the Battleship Arkansas. 16-inch cannons above the waterline, straight up and down, blown out of the water. And I got a picture of it, and I'll show it to you later, but I got a picture of it. And so that was kind of an interesting deal. So then after that, I went aboard the Boxer for a little bit, and then I was discharged at Marin.
There aren't too many people left now who saw what you saw, and even after the war with that atomic testing. You're one of the last people who witnessed that with your own eyes, and you saw firsthand the magnitude and the power that a nuclear weapon possessed. And now they're even incrementally more powerful than that, exponentially even. Knowing what you saw, what you felt, what you experienced, how thankful does that make you that no country since World War II has used one of those against an enemy?
Well, to me, I think one of the worst inventions ever probably was the atomic bomb. Because it's a scary thing even today. But I do remember after each blast, we'd sail into ground zero within an hour after they dropped the bomb, you know. And we were seeing all these little, at night, we saw these little fishes floating around, glowing. They were all radiated, I guess, you know. And I was thinking we were drinking that desalinated water. And I know my neighbor, he was a nuclear physicist at Diablo for a while. He moved, and now he's died. But anyway, he was kind of a joker. And he told them the reason I'm so healthy at my old age, because I received all those extra nukes at Bikini. So I don't know.
And the other thing that I thought of is you described what happened to the surface of the water when that underwater atomic weapon was detonated. That's not the only time you've been on some seas that were rocking and rolling. Because one thing we didn't talk about here was Halsey's Typhoon, Typhoon Cobra, the most infamous and devastating typhoon of World War II. And you got a taste of that too, didn't you?
I sure did, and I'll never forget it because everybody aboard ship got seasick except me. It seemed like everybody was seasick except me, and I never did get seasick, but I do remember thinking that I spent a whole lot of time at the helm on that thing because everybody was just seasick. And I do remember on the storm of the century, the swells in the middle of the northern Pacific, the swells were 70 feet swells. Can you imagine a swell in the middle of the ocean 70 feet high? And that's what we're going through with the winds, or between 150 and 180 miles an hour winds. So at the helm on that, as our ship went down into the swell, our ship would be submerged. And then it was going down at the helm. I could feel the rudder out of water. We'd lose steerage. And then we could, climbing back up again, I could feel the helm take over. And so I could get it back on course, but it was a real problem. And I do remember one thing, that a normal sea condition, the magnetic compass always swings back and forth quite a bit. But the gyro compass, you can usually keep it on course within 2 or 3 degrees. But that gyro, in this case, was really going just like the Magnetica. But anyway, I had a good time, but I wasn't afraid of anything. I would be if I had to go through it today, because I'm a little more experienced. But one thing I did enjoy was when I did get some relief from the helm for a few minutes, I'd go down to the galley and help myself to any kind of thing I wanted to eat. Now, here I'm a 17-year-old kid that eats a lot in those days. I'd help myself, and then I'd get back on the helm again and steer it. And
you'd help yourself because no one else had their sea legs enough to even go eat anything?
Yeah, nobody was eating anything. No, I guess that concludes about my war experiences. And like I say, I was no hero. I was kind of a passenger aboard a situation called World War II. But the real heroes are still there, you know, on Peleliu and different places. The Marines, those Marines, they're the heroes of the war.
Well, and you mentioned Honor Flight. You went with other veterans from here on the Central Coast back to Washington, D.C. People raise money, so you veterans get to go for free. And what you go see, a lot of things, but the centerpiece is that World War II memorial. And the whole purpose of it is to honor the guys you just called the real heroes, 406,000 Americans who didn't come home from World War II. So being there at that site, seeing all those gold stars, soaking all that in, what did it mean to you? What did you get out of that experience?
Patriotic, I think, more than anything else. When I think of the flag, for instance, the flag of the United States flag means more to me than it's almost religious to me, because I do remember after each battle we'd have a burial at sea, and I've got some pictures on my computer about that. And when I watch these guys being buried and the flags deflating as the bodies would go into the water, you know, these are my buddies that I've been sleeping with on board ship, you know, and that was kind of a rough situation. I'll never forget that. So to me, I think of the flag with reverence. You know, to me, that flag means everything to me. I just can't imagine anybody who wanted to do anything but salute it. And to me, that's what I think about now. It gives me a patriotic feeling.
Well, and we've covered so much with you. The childhood adventures that seem so dangerous to us now, enlisting in the Navy at 17, surviving the kamikaze attack, 38 years with the Bell Telephone Company, even switching entire hospitals over to new systems without interruption, all this incredible woodworking that adorns your home. When you think of all of that, I know that's a lot to consider. Is there something, though, that you would say that you're most proud of?
I think when I made the cut over St. Joseph of Orange, I think that's one of my epitome things that I did. I've had several experiences. One experience after my wife and I were married for 66 years, and she passed away in 2012. I went to the doctor, my knee doctor that I go to today, and he told me to read this book, A Proof of Heaven by Eben Alexander. And I read it, and one thing that was interesting to me when I was reading that book, he had an experience jumping out of an airport parachute with a group, and he had one situation where the chutes got tangled up, and he had a split second to make a decision. And he says, when that happens, all things go through your mind in split second, and they want to have a split second to make a decision. And I thought to myself, that happened to me twice that I can think of. One time was during World War II, and then the other time I was a troubleshooter working for the phone company. But I was walking to this one house, and our test board had dispatched me that they had trouble in their phone. And so I walked to the front door, and nobody was home. And so I walked around to the side. There's a passageway. One side was the wall of the house, and the other was a great big hedge, about 8 feet high with thorns and stuff in the hedge. And just as I poked my head around the corner, I saw this great big black dog running toward me, dripping at the mouth, growling. He looked like he was going to have me for lunch. So I had a split second to make a decision. Will I make it back to that gate? No. Will I climb the hedge? No. And there's only one thing left to do. And all of this comes in, I was thinking about it. A computer, for instance, is nothing but a pile of stuff sitting until it's bought by somebody, and then a brain takes it over and make all the decisions and stuff. And that's the same way with that. Our brain is a computer controlled by our soul. In this book I read by Eben Alexander, he was a neurosurgeon, he said that the soul takes over the thinking of split-second decisions. So you can imagine the split-second decision I had to make, and this big black dog running at me, ready to have me for lunch. There was only one thing left to do, was charge. So I put on my meanest face, and I started screaming, showing my teeth at him. I took one step toward him, and my hands front out where I was going to grab him and tear him to pieces. And we're just about to crash, and his rear end went down, and he kind of slid to a stop and right in front of me, and he turned around and whimpered, went back to the fence at the back of the house, you know, and he went whimpering back there. So from that moment on, that backyard was mine, and I was able to make my test. He kept an eye on me the whole time, but anyway, I walked back and went out, nonchalantly walked back out the front yard and left him there. And I was thinking, well, my soul must have taken over and given me the right decision, because it sure seemed to work.
Well, and when you said the other one was in World War II, I'm assuming you're talking about when you got hit by the kamikaze and you had to decide whether to jump in the water or not?
Yes, that's it. That was the one.
You talked about that a little bit, but just to clarify, what was the extent of your injuries? And in all these years since, I mean, 75 years about since that happened, has that ever bothered you? Have there been complications or issues because of it?
No. I do have some travel in my leg and one in my hip, and my wounds have all healed up pretty well, and that was it. So I'm fine. At my age, I feel like I'm doing pretty well.
Well, I saw you climb the stairs to give me a tour of all the incredible woodwork you've done around this place. But so what you're saying is when that bomb went off, it burned your arms and your torso and peppered shrapnel in your back and your legs. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, I got some shrapnel in my leg. Factually, the shrapnel wasn't discovered until I went to the Santa Barbara Hospital. They did an x-ray on my leg because I had knee trouble, and there were two shrapnels in there, and it's never bothered me a bit.
And nothing hit your head at all?
No.
And despite all that, despite the burns and the wounds, you spent the next 2 hours helping other guys who were wounded before you let them do anything for you?
Yeah, because I didn't know anything was wrong with me. I really didn't. There was so much to do, it was overwhelmingly, and that was it. No, I didn't know anything was wrong with me.
Well, I just wanted to make that clear, because I know you're making it very clear who you think the heroes are, but I think when people hear that story, they might assign that word to you too. And I want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling this story that only you could tell. Is there anything else that you think we ought to know about this life you've led?
No, except that I looked at my life back, I wouldn't trade a minute of it for anything. I've done stuff and learned stuff that probably many people never will, you know. And I've been a horse whisperer, a dog whisperer, and I love animals. That's it. I just lost my dog. I'm thinking of getting another one, but I'm getting too old, I think, now for another dog. But no, I wouldn't trade a minute of my life for anything, you know. I always looking for something to do, you know, and help somebody else, you know.
Your church, and you mentioned that book that you read about heaven. Have you ever felt that God was protecting you during those years, through all those things that you went through? I mean, when you're the only guy from your gun crew that survives, is that something that you've formed an opinion about one way or the other?
Oh, yeah. I have a guardian angel, believe me. I've been protected so many things, and my ability to build things, it's a God-given gift for sure, because I never had any other teacher. So I know that prayers are answered and that my Heavenly Father is watching over me, and I think about things like that. In fact, when you stop to think about it, every culture on earth, no matter what their religion or lack of religion, and the ancient people, they've always looked up to heaven, to a supreme being. And I'm interested in things like that. And I know that there's got to be a supreme being. And I believe that our Heavenly Father that's watching over all of us. And I'm a believer.
That is Dick Grantham, 93 years old. If you missed the first part of his story, catch the podcast online at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks to Bradley Hogan for introducing me to Dick, and thank you for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.